Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, August 14th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following: Yvonne Rogers Clark, 82, of Phoenix; Lori K. Hill, 62, of Mesa; George Matthew Labash, 87, of Phoenix; Tricia Lee Ross, 62, of Phoenix; and Jesse Uranga, 52, of the Valley. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of these individuals. And now we'll turn to the business section of the paper. It looks like there's a couple of articles here. One is entitled, Problems Grow for Troubled Resort. This was written by Karina Vanek for the Arizona Republic. The future of a $2 billion Ritz-Carlton Paradise Valley Resort development could be in jeopardy now that the lender has started foreclosure proceedings against the developer, while the developer alleges the lender's actions have ground progress to a halt. The development, which has already come in a series of stops and starts, began construction in 2018 near Lincoln Drive and Scottsdale Road. It was first announced back in 2007. Now, portions of the project, including several villas, which are condo-style residential units, have been completed. But the resort, which is the centerpiece of the development, it remains unfinished. Five Star Development, which is the developer of the 122-acre Ritz-Carlton Paradise Valley, received a $585 million loan from Madison Realty Capital in May 2023, used to finish construction of the resort and residences on the site. And at the time, the development team said the project was 80% complete. But now, Five Star Development is suing Madison Realty Capital, alleging that the lender is trying to undermine and take over the project, causing progress to stop and buyers to back out. Lawyers representing Five Star wrote in a lawsuit filed in Maricopa County Superior Court, quote, Madison delayed funding, withheld approvals, and weaponized its consent rights under the construction loan agreement to wrongfully force Five Star into financial concessions and chaos, with the ultimate goal of putting itself in a position to seize control and ownership of the project, unquote. Now, according to the lawsuit, Madison diverted resources to the villas instead of the hotel. Quote, as a result, the project, once nearing completion, has ground to a halt, unquote, according to court documents. Also in the court documents, they say this, quote, the hotel sits unfinished. Costs have ballooned. Buyers of the villas have backed out, and even more are threatening to do so, unquote. Now, many of the villas have been sold and are occupied by their owners. Prices for the villas sold between about $2.5 million to about $5.5 million, according to Maricopa County records. However, Paradise Valley was more interested in the tax revenue to be generated by the hotel than in the construction of the villas, and the allowance of the villas had been a concession by the town to get the resort. The town required substantial progress on the hotel as a condition of issuing certificates of occupancy for the villas, according to the lawsuit. Now, Five Star's attorneys wrote this as well. Quote, further, the town has refused to issue further certificates of occupancy required to successfully close sales on the villas because work on the hotel has stopped, unquote. According to the lawsuit, a town representative visited the site in June and informed Five Star that the town would not issue any further certificates of occupancy, and it would not reevaluate that decision until the end of summer. The unissued permits halts the sale of 40 villas, according to the lawsuit, which would have generated $150 million in revenue. Five Star's attorney wrote, quote, Madison's misconduct has not only stopped work on the hotel, wasted loan proceeds, and caused delay, but it has also now prohibited progress on the villas and further impaired Five Star's ability to repay the loan, unquote. The trustee sale for the property was scheduled for November 12th, according to Maricopa County documents. Both parties have until the last business day before the sale to file an objection and obtain a court order to stop the sale. And that was Karina Vanek's article, Problems Grow for Troubled Resort. Next up, we have an article entitled Navy Contract Gives Boost Raytheon's Tucson Facility. This was written by Russ Wiles for the Arizona Republic. Continuing a recent string of contract wins, Raytheon's Tucson operation has been given a new assignment to develop a defense system that protects ships against enemy aircraft and incoming missiles. The new $258 million Navy contract complements a $344 million ship defense contract that was awarded to Raytheon last April, with the new agreement allowing for follow-up integration and testing of the SM-2 missile system. Nearly three-fourths of the engineering and manufacturing work will be conducted in Tucson, with the rest spread among other states and a small slice in the United Kingdom, with expected completion by September 2031. Raytheon already ranks as the largest non-governmental employer in the Tucson area, with roughly 12,500 Arizona workers. The company did not provide an update on how many jobs might be added, if any, from the new contract. Raytheon's Tucson complex earlier this month won a $3.5 billion contract to make air-to-air missiles. That followed a $1.1 billion Navy contract in June. The Tucson operation also makes other defense products, including bunker-busting bombs and Tomahawk cruise missiles. The new contract for ship defense missiles, quote, signals the increased demand given the critical role these interceptors are playing for the U.S. and our allies, unquote. That's a quote from Barbara Borgonavi, who is president of Naval Power at Raytheon, in a prepared statement. Now, this work is to be conducted in Tucson, and then she added, quote, it incorporates several upgrades and will provide the U.S. Navy with a more capable and versatile missile for modern naval defense operations, unquote. Known as the SM-2, the missile system provides firepower against high-speed, highly maneuverable anti-ship missiles and aircraft. It is expected to be deployed for use in Navy Aegis destroyers and cruisers for several more decades. The missiles defend out to 90 nautical miles and up to 65,000 feet of altitude. More than 12,000 SM-2 missiles have been delivered to the U.S. and allied customers, which includes Australia, Canada, Germany, Japan, South Korea, the Netherlands, Spain, and Taiwan. Chile and Denmark will become two new SM-2 missile customers. The Navy confirmed that it fired SM-2 missiles to intercept anti-ship missiles and drones in the Red Sea in early 2024, when it defended against attacks by Houthi rebels targeting non-commercial vessels in the area. Raytheon is a division of RTX Corporation, which bills itself as the world's largest aerospace and defense contractor, with segments like Pratt & Whitney and Collins Aerospace. The company accounts for 185,000 global employees, and they generated a profit of $3.2 billion on $41.9 billion in sales over the first half of 2025. And that was Russ Wiles' article, Navy contract gives boost to Raytheon's Tucson facility. Our third article from the business section of the paper, China slaps duties on Canadian canola imports. This was written by Ella Kyo, Lewis Jackson, and Naveen Thukral for Reuters News Group, and it comes out of Beijing, China. China, on August 12th, announced preliminary anti-dumping duties on Canadian canola imports, a new escalation in the year-long trade dispute that began with Ottawa's imposition of tariffs on Chinese electric vehicle imports last August. The provisional rate will be set at 75.8%, effective from August 14th, the Ministry of Commerce said in a statement. Canola Council of Canada President Chris Davison said that rate makes the Chinese market effectively closed for Canadian canola, to which Canada exported almost $3.64 billion of the oilseed crop in 2024. Intercontinental Exchange November canola futures fell to a four-month low after the announcement. Trader Tony Troyhook of RBC Dominion Securities said, quote, "This really came as a surprise and a shock," unquote. China, the world's largest importer of canola, also known as rapeseed, sources nearly all of its supplies of the product from Canada. The steep duties would likely all but end imports if they are maintained. One Singapore-based oilseed trader said, quote, "This is huge. Who will pay a 75% deposit to bring Canadian canola to China? It's like telling Canada, we don't need your canola, thank you very much," unquote. China imposed tariffs on canola oil and meal in March. Canada is now in a trade conflict with the world's two largest economies, as it also faces tariffs on goods from the United States. Canada's top canola market is the United States, followed by China. China's Ministry of Commerce said an anti-dumping probe launched in September 2024 had found that Canada's agricultural sector, particularly the canola industry, had benefited from substantial government subsidies and preferential policies. The Canadian government and canola industry have previously rejected allegations of dumping. The industry believes that China's complaint is based on other ongoing trade and political disputes. A final ruling could result in a different rate or overturn the August 12th decision. But the decision marks a shift from the conciliatory tone struck in June when China Premier Li Qiang said there were no deep-seated conflicts of interest between the countries during a phone call with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney. Trivium China agriculture analyst Evan Rogers Pei said, quote, "This move will put additional pressure on Canada's government to sort through trade frictions with China," unquote. Canada's Trade, Agriculture, and Prime Minister's Office did not immediately respond to request for comment. Canada had imposed tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, steel, and aluminum. Separately, China also launched an anti-dumping investigation into Canadian pea starch and imposed provisional duties on imports of halogenated butyl rubber, according to ministry statements. Now, replacing millions of tons of Canadian canola is likely to be difficult at short notice, according to analysts. China uses imported canola to make animal feed for its aquaculture sector, as well as for cooking oil. The move provides an opportunity for Australia, which looks set to regain access to the Chinese market with test cargoes this year after a years-long freeze in the trade. Australia, the second largest canola exporter, has been shut out of the Chinese market since 2020, due mainly to Chinese rules to stop the spread of fungal plant disease. However, even if Australian imports increase, quote, "fully replacing Canadian canola will be very difficult unless import demand drops sharply," unquote, said Donatus Jankoskis, an analyst with commodity data from firm CM Navigator. Davison said his industry believes China will need Canada's canola to meet the sort of demand it has experienced in recent years. Davison said, quote, I think the expectation would be that they could not meet those needs with a quality of a product and a volume that we provide, unquote. Canadian farmers are about to begin harvesting canola and will not be happy to see prices plunge, said Canadian Canola Growers Association President Rick White. As long as the prohibitive duty is there, farmers face suppressed prices. White said, quote, it's going to certainly have a damping effect on price for farmers, and they're going to be stuck with that, unquote. Commodity funds have a substantial long position in canola futures, traders said, which should add fuel to the sell-off fire. Trahak said, quote, this will help accelerate their exit of that long and could really extend the losses, unquote. Another trader said there was already downward pressure coming into canola prices as Canada's crop is widely believed to be bigger than many previously forecast due to good weather. Ventum financial broker David Derwin said traders were unsure about how to take the Chinese move yet, since it is not a final rule. Darwin said, quote, is this a negotiating tactic, or does China put it in and that's that, unquote. And that was the article, China Slaps Duties on Canadian Canola Imports. Well, we're coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, so we'll move on over to the sports section now. At the top of the front page of the sports section is an article entitled Ex-Basha Star Gives Back to Schools Program by Richard Obert for the Arizona Republic. Right now, it is a paved dirt area just inside Chandler Basha High School's football stadium, but it will become the DeMond Williams Legacy Lawn in time for the football team's home opener on September 5th. And that's thanks to a donation from the Washington Huskies quarterback to the alma mater, where his stardom grew. It will include a large sign with Williams' picture, along with turf, picnic tables, cornhole games, and an area for fans to hang out during games. There are a stack of bricks in that area now. Students and teachers, current and former, will be able to buy a brick for $100 and have their name and class year stamped on it to be displayed at the lawn. The school grew into a football giant during Williams' four-year varsity run at the school from 2020 to 2023. Williams blew up the school's record book during his time there, leading the Bears to their only open division state championship his junior season in 2022. Williams, the top dual-threat quarterback, is expected to start this season for the Huskies after taking over starting duties in the latter part of 2024. He donated the Legacy Lawn to his alma mater with a portion of his NIL earnings. Basha coach Chris McDonald said, quote, we want to make it an area where parents, if they brought their little kids, could play. They can hang out. We're going to turn this into sort of a community area, unquote. Williams, a four-year varsity starter at Basha, amassed more than 10,000 yards and 93 touchdowns passing and more than 2,700 yards and 93 touchdowns rushing. His senior season was off the charts. 3,250 yards, 34 TDs, 3 interceptions passing, 1,136 yards and 20 touchdowns rushing, and a completion pass percentage of 76.8. McDonald said, quote, he did a lot for this school and this community. This is an opportunity for not just for him, but for a lot of our kids who have come through to someday come back, and they'll have their name on here. It will be pretty cool. It will spice up the stadium, too, unquote. For Williams wanting to give back to Basha, well, McDonald isn't surprised. He said, he's just that type of kid. He created a legacy. I think it's only right we do something like this, unquote. And that was ex-Basha star Gives Back to Schools Program. Then, in the middle of the page, there's a picture of a Diamondback player by the name of Ketel Marte. And he's running towards the dugout. He just hit a three-run home run with two outs in the ninth inning. And he gave the Diamondbacks a 6-4 lead against the Rangers at Globe Life Field on August 13th in Arlington, Texas. And the title right next to his head is Marte Delivers Again. This was written by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Republic, and it comes out of Arlington, Texas. A day after blasting the go-ahead ninth-inning homer from the right side of the plate, Ketel Marte did the same thing from the left side on Wednesday, August 13th, demolishing a three-run blast to lift the Diamondbacks to a 6-4 win over the Texas Rangers at Globe Life Field. The day began with the focus on the pitching matchup. Rangers right-hander Merrill Kelly, facing not just his old team 2 weeks after being traded, but also lining up to pitch against his close friend, Zach Gallen. But Marte stole the spotlight. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovullo said, quote, "He can take it to a whole new level, like, you know, a league above the major leagues. That's hard to do. There are only a few players that can do that," unquote. Trailing by 2 runs and down to their final out, the Diamondbacks rallied. James McCann ripped a solo homer off of right-hander Phil Maton to cut the Rangers' lead to 4-3, and after Blaze Alexander was hit by a pitch and Geraldo Perdomo took a 4-pitch walk, Marte hit a 1-1 curveball out to right field. Gallen said, "I was in the training room watching it, thinking, just let Marte get up with some runners on and see what happens. He got a mistake, and he didn't miss it," unquote. Marte's homer, his 4th hit of the day, left his bat at 105.7 miles an hour and landed about 10 rows deep in right field. The Diamondbacks departed town with a series victory, their 3rd in the past 4. They're still a ways away from calling themselves contenders again. At 59 wins and 62 losses, they still remain 6 games out of the final wild card spot. But with 4 games on deck against a putrid Colorado Rockies team in Denver, they have a clear opportunity to make things interesting. McCann was chatting with friends on the Texas Rangers before one of the games when the topic turned to the Diamondbacks' offense. He said both players, pitchers Jacob deGrom and Danny Coulomb, have commented on the strength of the lineup, noting that it is not an easy one to navigate, even after the departures of Eugenio Suarez and Josh Naylor at the deadline. McCann said, quote, "This is still a really good ball club. There are still some really good pieces. We've got multi-time all-stars in here. We got guys who have had Cy Young consideration in the past. This is still a very good team that's going to come out and compete." Talking to the guys with Texas, that's one thing they say. "You always line up, your team is really good." And that's after selling the pieces that you sold. Well, the 6th-inning comeback overshadowed what had been a strong performance by Kelly, whom the Diamondbacks traded less than 2 weeks ago. He gave up 2 runs in 6 innings, outdueling Gallen, who allowed 3 runs in 5 innings. Gallen said, quote, "I think he threw like we've been watching Merrill throw all year. I'm sure it was a little bit weird for him, but he went out and did his thing. He does a really good job of just kind of shutting that off and making pitches," unquote. Kelly said, quote, "It was kind of what I expected. A little anxiety to begin, leading up to the game, but then once the game starts, I've still got to execute. It's baseball, as usual," unquote. Over the past 2 days, Marte stood out at various points in every facet. He made a pair of tough defensive plays in the 2nd game of the series. He blasted homers, collected hits, and grinded through tough at-bats. He even tagged up from first on a routine fly ball, surprising the Rangers' Josh Smith in the 1st inning of the series finale. Kelly said, quote, "There's a reason why he was top 3 in the MVP last year. What you saw today in him is him in a nutshell," unquote. And then he added, quote, "He's kind of a guy you circle in that lineup that you don't want to beat you. But unfortunately, we let him beat us the past 2 days," unquote. Right-hander Anthony DeSchiafani was placed on the 15-day injured list on Wednesday, August 13th, with right thumb inflammation, opening a spot in the Diamondbacks' starting rotation. DeSchiafani had been dealing with the thumb issue for a few days leading up to his outing on Tuesday night, August 12th, versus the Rangers. He tried to pitch through, but it showed diminished velocity and allowed 2 runs in 3 innings before manager Torey Lovullo removed him from the game. DeSchiafani was replaced on the roster by right-hander Casey Kelly, who is expected to pitch out of the bullpen. The Diamondbacks have not yet decided who will move into the rotation in DeSchiafani's place. Right-hander Jake Woodford, who tossed 3 1/3 scoreless innings in relief of him on August 12th, is an option. The club is also considering a number of options in AAA Reno, including right-handers Bryce Jarvis and Dylan Ray, and left-hander Spencer Geistling. Another possibility is left-hander Cole Drake, whom the Diamondbacks acquired from the Rangers as part of the Merrill Kelly deal. Ray, Geistling, and Drake have yet to make their major league debut, and the club will have to decide if it wants to ask them to do so on Sunday, August 17th, at Coors Field, which is the most hitter-friendly ballpark in the majors. And that was the article, Mart Delivers Again. Then, our next article is entitled, Young L.B. Hughes Emerging as Key Player and Leader. This is by Michelle Gardner for the Arizona Republic. There is a rite of passage when it comes to the Arizona State football team and its annual trip to Camp Tontazona. The cabins are far from luxurious accommodations, and the freshmen usually bunk in the worst of the lot. Martell Hughes is entering his sophomore season after playing as a true freshman. On the team's recent trip to Camp Tontazona, he found himself once again in the freshman cabin. Hughes thought it might be beneficial to stick with the freshmen since he was in their position a year ago. Among those he has tried to mentor are Tristan Bacon and Isaiah Isofsoefa, both of them true freshmen. Hughes said, quote, I was supposed to be staying with the older guys in their cabin, but I wanted to stay with the younger guys. I just felt like a lot of the guys I came in with are still in our cabin, so I wanted to stick with them. I'm trying to be there for them because college football is tough. There's a lot to learn, and you're having to adjust. I know what it's like. Unquote. The 6 foot 2 inch 250 pounder appears to be the next young linebacker coming through Tempe. ASU has a senior trio of Jordan Crook, Keyshawn Elliott, and Zyrus Fiasu, who have drawn the bulk of playing time. Hughes is a bridge between the older set and the younger players. He played in third down packages, but has also found a niche as a contributor on special teams, earning Big 12 Player of the Week honors once for his showing there as the Sun Devils marched to a conference title their first season in the league. Linebackers coach A.J. Cooper says he sees Hughes not just as an emerging player, but a leader as well. He says Hughes has been able to learn how to lead from senior members of the program. Coach Cooper said, quote, he's got, in different ways, some good examples of leaders. A guy like Tate Romney, who is excellent with the young guys, who can bring a young guy aside and dap him up, tell him what to do. A guy like Jordan Crook, who can get on them, bring fire, bring passion to the room. Keyshawn Elliott is kind of in the middle, so leadership is about your personality. And Martell can see different pieces of people's personalities. He's getting better vocally. I'm starting to hear him more. He's gotten better. The confidence is there, unquote. Last season, Hughes played 138 snaps on defense, which was tied for the 12th most among all Big 12 defenders and 4th among true freshman linebackers in the league. Most of those snaps were on passing downs. He recorded his 3rd best special team score for a true freshman in the conference at 73.3. His breakout performance came in a 35-31 win over Central Florida when he blocked a punt, which Montana Warren returned 46 yards for a touchdown. And he registered another big play later when he made a tackle at the one-yard line on a botched kickoff return with under a minute remaining in the half. He made the final tackle of the contest to prevent the Knights from attempting another play. Hughes welcomes the chance to be on the field in any capacity. He says one of his goals is to get another block this season, and of course, he wants to see more playing time on earlier downs. He said, quote, "Patience is key, especially playing football at this level. You have to be able to learn and take things in day by day, and every opportunity you get, you have to take advantage of it. If that's playing special teams, just go with it. I like being out there and impacting the game any way I can," unquote. Hughes, who's a native of San Diego, said ASU has been perfect for him, both athletically and academically. He is majoring in sports business and is part of the Barrett Honors Program. Teammates Keith Abney and Kyson Brown are also in that program. He said, "I don't ever want to leave this place. I love it here. The way everybody loves on each other here, it's like a real family. I didn't see this in any other program. Everybody loves each other, even the new transfers. They have already bought into the culture," unquote. And that's the article, "Young L.B. Hughes Emerging as Key Player and Leader." Well, we're coming up on 32 minutes past the hour, and it looks like we've got one more article from the front page of the sports section. Birch shows encouraging signs for Cardinals. This was written by Theo Mackey for the Arizona Republic. On the second night of the NFL draft this past spring, Arizona Cardinals general manager Monty Ossenfort sat at a podium and kept landing on the same word to describe his third-round draft pick. "Jordan Birch," he explained, "is a unique guy with some unique athleticism who brings a unique skill set." Well, this is what drew the Cardinals to Birch during the draft process. It's also what has, in the months since, occupied the attention of their coaching staff. At 6 feet 4 inches and 280 pounds, Birch is monstrous for a defensive end. He would even be big for a defensive end. Aaron Donald spent his career playing at 280 pounds, and he is arguably the greatest defensive tackle of all time. But when you combine that size with Birch's athleticism, Ossenfort's description makes sense. Birch ran a 4.67 second 40-yard dash, an excellent number for anyone on the defensive line. In high school, he was used as a short yardage running back, a red zone wide receiver, and occasionally even as a quarterback. In college, he made highlight shows when he juked multiple defenders on a 36-yard rush off of a fake punt. He still moves like the kid who was reared on basketball, who played point guard even as he blossomed into his near 300-pound frame. As a sophomore in high school, he transferred from his small hometown of Florence, South Carolina, to the powerhouse in the state capital of Columbia, a move designed to increase his recruiting profile in both sports. The interest was real in basketball, too, with South Carolina head coach Frank Martin particularly enamored. But his size, though, quickly ensured that football would be his future. Eric Kimry, his high school football coach, said, quote, "You take one look at his build, and I looked at our basketball coach, and I go, hey, buddy, sorry, that's not a basketball player. That's an NFL football player. Put it all together, it's a package that few players can offer." Well, now for this flip side. In college, Birch could use his size and speed to rack up sacks. He finished his final season at Oregon with 8.5 sacks in 10 games. Most of them featured him running through the face of opposing left tackles because few college linemen could handle his natural traits. But in the NFL, that will not work as consistently. Birch acknowledged recently, quote, "They move a lot faster and they have better hands," unquote. Even in practice, he says, Cardinals left tackle Paris Johnson Jr. has shown him the chasm between college and the NFL. So, beginning in the spring, the Cardinals' coaching staff set out to work with Birch on his first step, explosiveness. Defensive coordinator Nick Rallis said, quote, "I really wanted to stress him just getting off the ball and accelerating. I want to see that burst," unquote. At the NFL level, this is key. If Birch can explode off the line of scrimmage, he will be able to access the rest of his skill set. If he can't, he'll constantly be a step behind the opposing tackle. It also comes less naturally for Birch. In the 40-yard dash, his time ranked in the 85th percentile among defensive ends and edge rushers, but his 10-yard split, the first 10 yards of his dash, well, it was slightly below average. It takes a beat to get his 280-pound body going at full speed. So addressing that first step has been a multi-part equation. The Cardinals focused on resistance training with Birch, a recent team-wide emphasis. They cleaned up his footwork. They instilled the importance of eye discipline. That's a football speak for not being distracted and keeping a focus on the opposing tackle. They also have him work more as a stand-up rusher rather than with his hand in the ground so that he can get into his first step quicker. And that has required training his balance. Birch said, quote, "It's a little bit different for me, but I've been just working on it, trying to keep my mobility out so I can bend the edge," unquote. It's a lot to put on the plate of a rookie, all while he's learning a new defensive system. But Birch's development is crucial for the Cardinals, not just because of their third-round investment. On the opposite side of the defensive line from Josh Sweet, the Cardinals are still searching for another edge rusher who can consistently get to the quarterback. Baron Browning has shined since coming over from Denver at that trade deadline last year, but he has never topped 5 sacks in a season. Zaven Collins is more valuable for his versatility than his work as a pure pass rusher. B.J. Ojulari is still recovering from the torn ACL. So while Browning and Collins remain clearly ahead of him on the depth chart, Birch has the potential to fill a valuable void. It's in that context that his preseason debut against the Kansas City Chiefs was so encouraging. Head coach Jonathan Gannon said, quote, "He was impactful. I thought he affected the quarterback," unquote. It wasn't just that Birch affected the quarterback, but how he did it. Twice, he generated near-instant pressure by coming off the edge and bending around the Chiefs' right tackle, the exact type of pass rush on which he has trained his focus this summer. Well, all of the typical preseason caveats are worth noting here. Those two plays came against a career backup and a camp body. But given everything that Birch has put into the past 4 months, it felt like it represented more than that. Birch said, quote, "It felt good. Coach was like, just let it fly. Don't do too much thinking. And that's what I tried to do," unquote. And that was the article, "Birch Shows Encouraging Signs for Cardinals." Well, we're 38 minutes past the hour, and we've just covered the front page of the sports section. Let's turn the page over and see what's inside. How about a little NBA news? Here's an article by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. Suns left off Amazon Prime NBA Cup group play coverage. The Phoenix Suns announced Wednesday, August 13th, their NBA Cup group play schedule for the 25-26 season. The NBA released its entire NBA Cup schedule with dates. The Suns are in West Group A with the defending NBA champions, the Oklahoma City Thunder, Minnesota Timberwolves, Sacramento Kings, and Utah Jazz. The Thunder defeated the T-Wolves in the Western Conference Finals to advance to the 2025 Finals. October 31st, it'll be the Jazz at the Suns. November 21st, the T-Wolves at the Suns. November 26th, the Suns at the Kings. November 28th, the Suns at the Thunder. And the Suns open the 25-26 regular season on October 26th against the Sacramento Kings at PHX Arena. The full 25-26 NBA schedule is set to be released August 14th. Amazon Prime Video is showing 5 doubleheaders during NBA Cup group play. And it lists those dates, and there are no suns in any of those dates, like October 31st, for example, October 31st, Boston Celtics, and the Philadelphia 76ers, and the Los Angeles Lakers and the Memphis Grizzlies. Or on November 7th, the Houston Rockets and the San Antonio Spurs, and the doubleheader, the other game was the Golden State Warriors and the Denver Nuggets. None of those five events have the Phoenix Suns in them. None of the West Group A games are being broadcast on Amazon Prime. It's the only group that doesn't have a group play game scheduled on the streaming service. Only one West Group A game is being nationally televised, and that's Minnesota at Oklahoma City on November 26th on ESPN. Now, Amazon Prime is part of the 11-year media rights deal with the NBA, along with Disney and NBC Universal for $76 billion. And that deal runs through the 2035-2036 season. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, when the deal was signed in July, said, "Our new global media agreements with Disney, NBC Universal, and Amazon will maximize the reach and accessibility of NBA games for fans in the United States and around the world. These partners will distribute our content across a wide range of platforms and help transform the fan experience over the next decade." And that was the article, Suns Left Off Amazon Prime NBA Cup Group Play Coverage. Well, we're coming up on 42 minutes past the hour. So let's move on over to the opinion section and read an opinion piece. We have Lori Roberts' column. It's entitled, Gallegos' Rise Must Be Bitter for Lake. There is Ruben Gallego, the neophyte Arizona senator, posing in front of the famed Butter Cow at the Iowa State Fair and barnstorming across the Midwestern state that broke big for Donald Trump in 2024. And there is Ruben Gallego, back in Arizona, and going where Republicans fear to tread, holding a town hall in Globe, and taking a question from a three-time Trump voter at another town hall in Apache Junction. And there's Ruben Gallego, all over the headlines. The Associated Press, which along with the rest of the national media covered Gallego's Iowa tour over the weekend, said, quote, "Hundreds cheer Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego as Democrats take offensive against Trump's tax bill," unquote. Quote, "His party reeling, a Democratic senator tries a message of hope in Iowa," unquote, says the New York Times. The Hill said, quote, "Gallego energizes Iowa voters amid 2028 speculation," unquote. Gallego, after 8 whole months as a U.S. senator, is coy when asked if he's running for president. He told 12 News' Bram Resnick during a walk and talk in Des Moines, quote, "Right now, running for president is out of the question," unquote. Well, right now. Right now, he's busy building a national profile, one that clearly threatens Republicans. Turning Point USA dispatched a handful of hecklers to shadow Gallego in Iowa, no doubt hoping to needle the senator into returning to the more profane and hair trigger of Gallego of old, but he didn't bite. He, quote, I'm a mature adult now," unquote, he told reporters when asked about a profane comment he made about the Iowa caucus 5 years ago. And then he went on and said, "And what I said was, you know, dumb of me." Iowa Republican Party Chairman Jeff Kaufman issued a statement calling Gallego out of touch and out of his depth. The National Republican Congressional Committee complained that he isn't here to fight for Iowans. He's fighting for his own political ambitions. Even Carrie Lake, still seething over her loss to Gallego in last year's Senate race, took time away from slavishly praising Trump and dismantling the Voice of America to note her archenemy's presence in her native state. She huffed and said, "Iowa gave me the opportunities and lessons I needed to become the woman I am today. It's a uniquely patriotic and special place. That's something a far-left radical like at Ruben Gallego will never understand." Well, in a way, Gallego owes a big portion of his new national profile to Lake. While Trump won Arizona by nearly 6 points, Gallego won the Senate seat by more than 2 points. It was the largest gap of any state with a split presidential Senate outcome. Gallego credits his win to his outreach to Latino men and working-class voters. But it didn't hurt that he was running against one of the most legendarily terrible candidates the state has ever seen. While Trump took Arizona and Republicans won every swing congressional seat and boosted their margin in the legislature, Gallego defeated Lake. So now he's a national figure, and I believe him when he says he isn't looking at 2028, but at 2026. While Republicans try to gerrymander Texas to pick up congressional seats and preserve their slim majority in next year's midterm elections, Gallego is out and about in the state and the country talking about issues that matter to voters, things like the impact of Trump's massive tax cuts for the wealthy and the coming steep cuts to Medicaid, about Biden's miserable record on the border and the need to own up to past mistakes, and about the need to win back working-class voters. The once liberal firebrand knows that Democrats must move to the center if they want to quit wandering the political desert. Gallego told the New York Times while he was in Iowa over the weekend, quote, "There's no governing coalition until we start winning here, and we know how to do it. I know how to get the message to do it," unquote. Gallego will travel to New Hampshire later this month to spread that message. If the Democrats succeed, they will have Gallego in large part to thank for it. And Gallego? We in Arizona all know who he has to thank. I picture her grinding her molars into dust. And that was Lori Gallego's opinion, Lori Roberts' opinion piece, Gallego's Rise Must Be Bitter for Lake. Coming up on 47 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on over to the entertainment section now. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. We're going to begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you making the first move? Today's auspicious connection between Mercury and Mars works its magic on your love life. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th. Are you asking for the help you need? Mercury's connection to Mars delivers the goods. You are in the home stretch now. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st. Do you have a packed calendar? Well, get out on the scene today. Mercury and Mars's mingle is set to spice up your social life. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd. Are you getting to the heart of the matter? Have the hard talk. Being straightforward delivers success. For Leos, birth dates from July 23rd through August 22nd. Are you stating the obvious? As Mercury and Mars harmonize, do not wait to take for permission to take action. Walk your talk. For Virgos, you fellow Virgos out there, birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd. Are you choosing the right investments? Because as Mercury harmonizes with Mars, you know exactly which project or venture deserves your energy. For Libras, birth dates from September 23rd through October 23rd, are you acting with purpose? You will find your direction working on behalf of others. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birth dates, speaking with authority is only half the magic as Mercury and Mars harmonize. Your aura has an impact as well. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birth dates, get others' input while playing to your strengths. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birth dates, be uncompromising. Decisiveness earns you professional respect. Claim the authority you deserve. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, are you achieving a compromise? Everyone can be a winner. Highlight what you have in common. And finally, for Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Smart strategizing is your strength. Appeal to a coworker's ego to get what you desire. And that was today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. First letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my parents divorced when I was in high school, and Dad kept the house I grew up in. I'm in college across town and have my own place, but I still visited Dad often. As a teenager, it used to be my job to cook the family dinner two nights a week. I loved it and continued to cook when I was visiting. Dad now has a serious girlfriend who has moved in with him. She's uncomfortable with a guest being in her kitchen and says it's appropriate for me to only be in the living room when I visit. If I want a glass of water, I'm supposed to ask her for it. She calls it being a good host, but it feels like a power move to push me out. Dad says it's her house and her rules. I'm sad that what was my home for 18 years is now off limits. I get that she's insecure about the relationship and wants to put some distance between me and my dad, but I no longer feel welcome in the house I grew up in because she is so rigid. I have invited them both to my place, but they haven't accepted. What do I do now? Signed, Pushed Out in Arkansas. And Abby responds, Dear Pushed, your father's girlfriend appears to be both controlling and insecure, and your father has made clear that he doesn't want to rock the boat. Under the circumstances, you have no choice but to follow the new house rules. If you can abide by them, visit your dad. If you can't, reconcile yourself. Then you may have to wait for him to miss your presence in his life before he will consent to be a guest at your place. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I am an animal person. I love all kinds, but when it comes to dogs, I don't like the smell, the mess, the fur, the jumping, the slobbering, and the general mayhem of an untrained dog. My spouse's family has many dogs, big and small. They are not trained. The family prefers them that way. They think it's cute when they jump or climb on a visitor's lap. They believe it's a way to win people over. Their dogs are allowed on the furniture, making it very smelly. They also feed them while we're at the dinner table. I understand people love their pets and treat them like family, and I wouldn't expect them to change their ways for me. But I also don't see why I should subject myself to something that disgusts me. Is there a polite way to tell them I'm not comfortable eating or visiting in their home? I've learned the quickest way to pick a fight is to say, I don't like dogs, to a dog person. I have a cat, but would never dream of dragging her out in public or to someone's home. My in-laws also allow smoking in their home. I'm a non-smoker. I don't do bad smells well. Have you any advice? Signed, In the Doghouse in Florida. Dear Doghouse, I sure do. Be open and honest with your dog-loving in-laws. Tell them exactly what you have written to me. And now trust me on this, you won't be subjected to their hospitality again. Problem solved. Don't forget, you can contact Abby by going to her website, www.dearabby.com. And now I think we have time for a few comics. In the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, in the first frame, Dagwood is at the office, and he's walking out the door into the hallway, and he's holding, looks like his cell phone in his hands, and he says to the cell phone, Okay, here it goes, one last shot. And in the next frame, he's in Mr. Dithers' office. Mr. Dithers is sitting at his desk, and he turns to look at Dagwood. And back in the doorway, there's two or three employees peering around the corner watching what's going on. And Dagwood says, Alexa, put the boss in Ray's giving mood. In the last frame, Dagwood's coming in the house after work. And Blondie says, Did he give you anything? And Dagwood says, Yep, 2 seconds to get out of his office. and that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, also drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, in the first frame, there's Hammy in bed, and his little sister Zoe is standing next to the bed, and Mom Wanda is standing right behind Zoe with her hands on her hips, and she looks kind of disgusted. And Zoe says, "I'm sorry I told you there were monsters under your bed." And the next frame, Wanda turns, starts to walk out of the room, and Zoe says, "Maybe it would help if you counted sheep." And in the last frame, as Zoe starts to walk out of the room, she says, "Just not the brain-eating types." And Mom yells from off the frame, "Zoe!" And Hammy covers up under the covers and yells, "Ah!" And that was Baby Blues. And in the comic strip Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, there's Earl sitting on the sofa, kind of leaning back, and the dog Roscoe's sitting in his lap. And his daughter comes in and says, "Are you okay, Dad? You look tired." And he goes, "I am." And she leans over the back of the sofa and says, "Why are you so tired?" And he goes, "Shopping." And she looks, "You've been shopping with Mom? But the stores aren't even open yet." And the last frame, he says, "Yeah, I know, but they will be. I've got a case of anticipatory exhaustion." And that was Pickles. Hey, before we go, let's wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Looks like Steve Martin, the comedian, actor, and writer, he turns 80 today. And actress Halle Berry turns 59. And actress Mila Kunis turns 42. Congratulations. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sunsounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, August 14th, 2025. Have a great day.